Good afternoon. I'm calling the Finance Committee together at 1:32. Present today are Representative Munoz, Representative Holmes, Representative Guttenberg, Representative Costello, Representative Stoltz, myself, Representative Osterman, Representative Wilson, Representative Edgman, Representative Thompson, Rosenberry, excuse me, Representative Newman. Today we're going to go ahead and start the general overview of the governor's budget by different state agencies, and we're going to start with the Department of Corrections. Then we'll have the Department of Revenue with a fall forecast and state savings account update. Mr. Schmidt, you want to join us, and whoever else you're going to have present today, and we'll turn the meeting over to you. And normally during these presentations, I would prefer that questions be held until the presentation's all done, and that way we don't disrupt the meeting.
Oh, okay. We have the right to remain silent. We're instructed to do so, right?
Do.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you. I'm Joe Schmidt, Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. To my right is Ron Taylor, Deputy Commissioner. He's in charge of operations and prisoner reentry. Leslie Houston is our Deputy Commissioner in charge of the administrative functions, medical, and the training academy. And in the front row, we have April Wilkerson. She's our director. She's new to the position this session, and she's taken over as Director of Administrative Services. And we have our Ledge Liaison, Special Assistant Casey Schroeder. And so hopefully the front row folks, if there's questions that come up that we have to get back to people on, they can make sure we don't forget and do that. So that's who's here with me today. I had an overview of the department. Do we have an hour, sir? Is that our time frame? I think we can keep to that overview and talk a little bit about some trends that we're seeing, and then Mr. Taylor is going to talk about some outcomes, both reformative programming and reentry, and then Ms. Houston is going to talk a little bit about some of the collaboration we're doing with other departments, and of course our budget overview. So, starting of course with our mission statement, it's a three-piece mission statement we put out in about 2007-2008: secure confinement, reformative program, supervised reentry, pretty much in that order. And making sure that we're doing good assessments on people, and who are we afraid of and who are we mad at. And that's kind of a little saying that we have. Someone who's actively dangerous is what secure confinement is for. It's very expensive, and we want to make sure that we're not over-confining people that don't need it, because it's expensive when it doesn't need to be. And it can be programmatically harmful. Reformative programs, of course, keeping them busy while they're incarcerated, using that time productively, and returning back to the communities is about recidivism reduction. We'd all like to have a prevention program where we prevent the first crime, but by the time an adult comes to our system, it's too late for that. So we tend to focus on recidivism, which is preventing the next set of crimes. So we're one of six states in the nation that has a unified system, which means we handle and house all the misdemeanors and felons that are both less than and more than a year of sentence. We booked 39,000 offenders last year. What I'd like to say about that, a couple things. Nearly 4,000 of them were Title 47, which is the non-crim. It's the inebriate on the street who's at risk of, his safety's at risk or his life is in danger. And if they can't go to a sleep-off or to a family or home or something like that, they come to jail, and there was 4,000 of those. Another point I'd like to make about that particular bullet, while we did 39,000 bookings, it was actually 23,000 unique individuals. In other words, 23,000 people came to jail 39,000 times. Some of them came once, some of them came twice, some of them came three times. Leslie found today one of them came 45 times. So there are some what we call frequent flyers. We have the same type of numbers with our 4,000 Title 47 folks that come in, and there was just about half of those, 2,000 unique individuals. So what we're talking about is a lot of repeat offenders here. 45 is an outlier. They're not all recidivating 45 times, but it kind of illustrates we get people coming back an awful lot. So we've had about 6,000 people in a prison community residential center, which is also known as a halfway house, and an electronic monitoring program. Counts today, those are all lumped together, 6,000 in different capacities of incarceration. Count today in the CRCs or the halfway houses was 754, and our electronic monitoring program is 381. So what we have there is just over 1,100 offenders that are out on those two programs. The remaining 5,000 are locked up in the jail beds. very close to 6,000 offenders on probation and parole, about equal with what's in prison. We have 13 facilities statewide with a capacity of 5,352 beds. One of the things we're doing this year with our budget as a means of reduction was we're rolling the Point McKenzie Correctional Farm, which is 128 beds, into the Goose Creek operation where we have empty beds yet. And we're not going to slow the farm down. The production, the vegetables, the animals, all those kinds of things are going to remain as they have been. We're just going to run work crews from Goose Creek to the farm. And what we can do is just collapse that operation and reduce our budget a little bit for that. We have 13 field probation offices. We have 8 contract CRCs or halfway houses with a capacity of 839 beds. And we have electronic monitoring in 6 of our communities and with a capacity of 385. As I said, count today was 381. That program, by the way, is running at 95%. 95% of the people that we put into that program finish without any incidents. They finish their time without coming back to jail or committing a violation. The 5% that fail are almost all technical violators, hot UAs, missing an appointment, those kinds of things. So it's a very, very effective program. And I've asked Ron in the last couple of weeks to start looking at ways to expand that. We think with a 95% success rate, we have room to push that program a little more. We've got a little bit of budget capacity that we think we can move some things around and push it above where it is right now. Stay tuned. I mean, more to come. I can't promise right now what we're going to drive it to, but we would like to explore that. One of my future slides is when we need a new prison, when our beds are, you know, when the grass crosses, when we're out of prison beds again. That's one of the things. You know, we certainly would never use a CRC or electronic monitoring because we're crowded or anything like that. We only put people out there that are appropriate for it and would benefit from it. But it is something that does alleviate very expensive prison beds. So that's kind of what's happening on the EM front. 15 regional community jail contracts, 157 beds out there. And, of course, reformative programming is something that Ron's going to talk a little bit about some of our outcomes here in just a minute. That's quite a heavy push we put upon the department, again, to use their time productively while we have their full attention while they're locked up. So trying to pay attention to what we're releasing back into the community. 95% of our people get out, and they all go back to the communities they came from. So we try to pay attention to what we're putting back out there. The next slide is simply where we have the jails and the state prison facilities. Supervised release is a map that shows where we have our electronic monitoring programs, our field probation offices, and our halfway houses. It's a little hard to see the green. I think we can kind of see the green. The electronic monitoring is in green. Fairbanks, Anchorage, Sitka, Ketchikan, and Kenai. That's where I have those. The next and last couple slides that I have are some trends that we're seeing, and it's a slide we used last year. Of course, it's new numbers now. Violent versus nonviolent. And when we come before you to show you this picture, you can see 11 years ago, we were 44% nonviolent, which is about roughly 13% under half, and now we're 57% nonviolent. So there's been quite a shift there between nonviolent and violent offenders. It appears by this that we are incarcerating a bigger number of nonviolent offenders. I would like to say, we're not here to say that we think that's wrong. Well, our job is to do what the public needs for us to do, and this happens because of laws that are passed and sentencing and all those kinds of things. So we don't want to come across like this is the wrong thing to do or anything like that, but we have been talking about the expense of prisons over the last few years, and I would like to show a picture to the public so they can see what we're filling our prisons with. And we can handle nonviolent offenders in some ways are easier than violent offenders, so we're certainly not complaining, but I think it's important the public knows the way that we're trending there. The next slide kind of dovetails, and it talks about how long people are doing, how much time people are getting, how long are their sentences. The significant one here that jumps out at me is the yellow block, the 3 years and more. It's called 37 months or more. 11 years ago, it was just over 10%, and now it's nearly 19. It's almost doubled. So what it would appear from these two slides is nonviolent people are getting more time. Where did that group come from, right? Who's getting less time to encompass, because this is all a percentage. And what it looks like, the group of people that was getting between 1 and 2 years is significantly smaller now than it was. So what it looks like is 10 years ago, someone that was getting between 1 and 2 years has been pushed up the scale, either into 2 to 3 or more than 3. But again, significantly, the biggest expense is going to be the 37-month or more. So again, we're not here to complain about that. We just want to show the picture so everyone can kind of see and have a discussion about which way we want to go as time goes on. females. Our female population 11 years ago was just under 10%, and it's up over, it's about 12.5% right now. Again, that's not an alarm right now. We're not alarmed by that. We're not in trouble today. But their growth rate, the growth rate of the overall population is very close to 3%. We did some detailed math on our next slide I'm going to show you, and we're at 2.69. Female growth is just over 6. And so if that trend continues, our discussion is going to have to be where do we put them? You know, what kind of jail facilities do we need? One thing I can tell you is with our female offenders, 12% of them are locked up in prison facilities. Our halfway houses have 15% females. Our probation caseload is 21%, and our electronic monitoring is 27%. So as we get lighter on the physical and programmatic supervision, the percentage of females tends to climb. So just another a way that that our system has been moving forward. Here's the graph on when our intersecting lines. The red line is how many prison beds we have, and the blue line is how many prisoners we have. Obviously, we're doing projections. When the line gets straight there, you know, we're talking about a projection. We're using 2.7% instead of 3 because our year-to-year growth has been 2.69. So we don't want to overproject. Prisons are expensive. If you look at the red line, it dips a little bit after 2014. That's because we're taking 128 beds out when we cage the Point Mac Farm facility. It's 128 prisoners that move into Goose Creek. So what's significant about this, we've been saying for a couple years the lines cross in 2016, and they do. However, they cross in 2016, and we have 128 beds that one day obviously we're going to add back in when we outgrow Goose Creek and we need the farm beds back. That's one thing we'll likely do. And so I can't promise yet how far we are, but it's looking like that it might have moved a little bit since we started talking about it. This graph also does not take into account any increases we find for the electronic monitoring program. It doesn't account for successes in probation supervision that Mr. Taylor's going to talk about in just a minute. We're seeing some pretty exciting trends. We haven't solved criminality in Alaska yet, but we're seeing some dips where we want to see dips, and we're seeing some increases where we want to see increases in a 1, 2, and 3 percentage point range. So we're excited about those trends, and if they continue, you know, that all those things will tend to affect where those lines cross and when we have to start a discussion on either expanding or building again. So I think we come to work to make sure we don't need another prison. I think we don't want to plan to fail and ask for something that we project to need when we hope that our plans work and we don't need one, you know, anytime soon. So that's how that goals. Obviously, protect the public. That's the first thing in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 12. That's what our department is supposed to do. Every decision we make, including the electronic monitoring placements, the half, all that kind of stuff, is always to protect the public. We're very happy with our new assessment tools, and we've updated our classification system, and we've been having pretty good results with the prisoners that we assess and move through our system. They don't all pass. I mean, some of them fail, of course, but they're failing a little bit less than they used to. Trends are, we think, moving in the right direction, and every decision we make somehow, our rule is it has to somehow protect the public. And even if that means put them in a program where they're going to have a better chance of not recidivating again, that's protecting the public. So if we can safely do it, that's what we're trying to do. Recidivism I've talked about. We want everyone to spend their time productively. We have them in jail, and they can sit there and watch TV, or they can go to, you know, do push-ups, or they can go to vocational class, and they can do some of these other things. And we're heavily pushing them towards motivating them every way we can towards being productive. Now, we have certain things we can do within the system. What kind of property are you allowed to have on your person and in your cell when you lock down at night? All these kinds of things we use, we've tied those things, property allowance, to program participation and behaving yourself and all those kinds of things. So, and Ron's going to talk about some numbers. We're moving the right direction on that. We're getting an increasing number of people involved, and we think that's going to have a good result. Of course, working collaboratively with outside stakeholders. That includes other departments and any of the community groups that Ron's going to speak about, because it's the community where these folks are going. And you know, we don't know what the answer is, but we know if there's an answer, it's out in the community. That's where it's at. When the community's engaged, we win. We have very few problems when the community's engaged. So the more we have a boundary that we're supposed to stay in. Our budget's only supposed to be for certain things, of course, and we stay within our boundaries. But the more we can engage the community and get them active in what we do, the better off this business is going to be. So, If it's okay, I'll turn it over to Mr. Taylor to talk about some of our outcomes.
That'll be fine. I just want to note that Representative Guerra has been with us for the last 10-15 minutes.
Mr. Chair, do you want the questions after everybody's spoken?
Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ron Taylor. As the commissioner said, I'm the deputy commissioner overseeing operations and reentry. And I'd like to talk to you for a few minutes about the reentry outcomes that we've been involved in or that we're seeing. The first that we'd like to talk about is those who are actually completing probation and parole. And they're actually satisfying their conditions of release. If you look at the line from 2010 to 2013, you'll see how it has continually increased. But specifically over the last 2 years, the dramatic increase in terms of those who have been completing their probation and parole requirements. Part of this has to go back to March 2011, when our former deputy commissioner worked with stakeholders throughout the community to develop the five-year reentry plan. For us, that really raised awareness inside of our system of some of the gaps in the services that we were providing or not providing, and it began to highlight for us the real importance of focusing in on the main drivers to our guys coming back into the system for remands or for bookings. And as you well know, probation and parole violations have consistently over the years been our number one and two drivers that have brought people back into our system. And so for us to see the increase in the number who are successfully satisfying their conditions, that means they're actually going through programming, they're staying clean and sober, and they're doing the things that the court or the parole board are asking them to do as part of their overall requirements. This also is interesting, we also have noticed during that same time period, from 2010 to 2013, that the overall remand numbers have actually been decreasing. So we had a high over 42,000 remands that we had back in 2010, and now we're down to 39,000. And so that shows over the last 4 years we've actually been decreasing, and a lot of that has to do with those that are completing their probation and parole requirements. So what does this have to do with overall criminal recidivism reduction? Well, from 2006 to 2010, what you can see is that those persons, especially at the end of 2010, who've actually been out of our institutions for a period of 3 years, are actually coming back fewer than they were back in 2006. Take that into account with where we are now with 2013, and you've seen the dramatic increases in terms of probation and parole increases, program completions, and what you're actually going to see is that this recidivism rate is going to continue to drop, and hopefully a little bit more aggressive than what we've seen in terms of a couple of points here and there over the last 4 or 5 years. Programming. We're ensuring that our programming is aligned with our risk needs assessment. And for us, that's probably been the biggest change in what we'll talk about in our subcommittee hearings over the next couple of weeks, is that whatever we find out in terms of the needs of our population inside the institution, we need to ensure that we have programming inside the institution that addresses those needs. We're very comfortable with the programs that we have. There's some tweaking that we need to do in terms of adding some additional outpatient and aftercare services for substance abuse, and our education programs, our CAP program, our criminal attitudes program is what the CAP is. We're showing right now a 7% reduction in recidivism for those who are actually going through and completing the CAP program. That's a preliminary data that we've got from a study that's being done by Dr. Samord out of Canada on our program. And then in terms of increasing the number of sex offender probationers who complete their sex offender management program, you can see that over the last few years, we've steadily increased the number who are actually being successful in terms of polygraphs and completing their overall requirements for sex offender management. That's actually gone up to 442 unique individuals who are actually completing the programs. And then general education. This is something that when the commissioner took office that we really focused heavily on in terms of ensuring people would go through and complete their education requirements. Now we know that there are some changes that's going to happen to the whole GED format and the testing format that's impacting some of the numbers now. But obviously what this shows us is that we need to do some renewed efforts to increase the number of GED certificates that people are getting while they're incarcerated. And what are our challenges and issues that we're facing in our department? Continually trying to meet the overall 24/7 operational needs while remaining within our fiscal parameters. The next one is the big one that we're focusing on right now. It's connecting soon to release offenders to community-based resources. I think what we've struggled to find is that there was and has not been over the last few years that direct connection between those persons who were in the institution needing programming and those who were connecting to some sort of service on the outside. Right now we have several reentry centers in Anchorage that we're proud of and we can certainly speak to, as well as a renewed effort in our reentry community to step up and meet the needs of our guys that are actually being released. And for us, I think a big challenge that should be highlighted in here is that the female population, as the commissioner talked about, we have a higher percentage of females in our system, and with that they bring a different set of problems than their male counterparts. They bring more financial issues that they need to have counseling and peer support programming for, as well as emotional support that we need to address. And since 2001, the medical costs have continued to increase in Anchorage, 63%, compared to the nationwide average of 52.1%. And the more that we're dealing with an aging population, they have more chronic health issues. This continues the need for higher acuity and specialized medical care for our population. And so those are things, challenges that I think the department has done a very good job in trying to keep contained and ensure that we're staying within our fiscal parameters that we've been given. And our Deputy Commissioner Houston will cover what else we're doing in the department.
Thank you. And for the record, Leslie Houston, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Corrections. And what else? I feel so short in here. First slide there is on our Alaska Grown, correctly applying the state procurement rules and putting an emphasis in educating our food services staff. We have increased our purchasing of Alaska Grown produce pretty significantly over the past 4 years. Interdepartment resource sharing. As positions and budgets shrink, we continue to tighten our belt. We look to our counterparts and other departments for what types of resources we can share. DOC has a centralized pharmacy and one pharmacist to serve all institutions. And with the return of the folks from Goose Creek, that presented an extra challenge for us, and our one pharmacist was unable to take vacations and sometimes, you know, needed a little bit more assistance in the backup. So we have an RSA agreement with the Department of Health and Social Services to utilize their Medicaid pharmacist for relief services, either when our pharmacist wants to take a vacation or we're just backed up. Also with the Department of Health and Social Services, we provide food service for the Bethel, Juneau, and Nome youth facilities. This summer, the Department of Labor was notified there was a shortage of J-1 visa immigrants for seafood processing. So we partnered with the Department of Labor and provided minimum custody inmate labor for the seafood processing in Kenai and Seward. With the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, we have been doing the Alaska Marine Highway laundry out at the Lemon Creek Correctional Center facility for several years. But now we're looking at expanding that into developing new agreements, either to assist with brush clearing, snow removal, and we're also pursuing a potential to go back into the garment industry for AMHS only. And giving back, we wanted to demonstrate some of the good that inmates do provide to the communities. At Highland Mountain Correctional Center, for example, the inmates made and contributed 90 quilts, 30 hats, and 30 scarves to Valley Elders. A team of inmates at Highland Mountain Correctional Center provided a community work service on the trail system nearby the facility. Throughout the summer and fall of 2013, our folks at Palmer Correctional Center do as they always do, the minimum custody. They do the garbage pickup for the roadsides. Our inmates, again, at Palmer Correctional Center do a hobby wood shop, and they've constructed over 700 wooden toys, cars, and trucks for donation to local charities. And similar to the dog obedience program at Highland Mountain Correctional Center, we have a cell dog program at the Wildwood Correctional Center in Kenai. This is a program where local shelters donate dogs who need a little extra obedience training that makes them a little bit more prepared to be adopted by families. And again, at Wildwood Correctional Center, a group of prisoners organized a fundraiser for a local child with pediatric cancer and was able to donate $1,375 to the family. And again, our Wildwood Correctional Center is busy knitting hats to benefit the Relay for Life so everybody could wear their pink beanie. Arts and crafts program at Yukon Kuskokwim Correctional Center in Bethel resulted in crocheted hats and headbands, and that were donated to the pre-maternal home, the Tundra Women's Coalition, and local schools. And to go into our FY15 budget changes, we are seeking an increment of $935,600, and this is for salary and health insurance adjustments associated with all bargaining unit contracts. Let's see, maintaining current levels of service, you'll see our negative number there of $4,036,500. $2.5 million of that is by closing the housing at Point McKenzie Work Farm and moving those inmates over to Goose Creek. In physical health, I never thought I would be saying that we had a lapse of $1.6 million, and that is decremented proportionately. That said, we could also be turning around and seeking a supplemental or something in the future, or next year seeking an increase, because we don't have any control over the medical conditions and the health of those who enter our doors. And the $65,000 federal under the maintenance of current levels of service, this is for our RSAT, the Residential Substance Abuse Treatment Program. Traditionally, this had been a pass-through grant from public safety to DOC. This transaction makes it in the base of DOC, so that pass-through relationship no longer exists. For our mental health trust, they do the zero-based budgeting, so they take us down to zero. So that's the negative number you see. And then the mental health trust recommendations are coming back at a slightly elevated level of $474,400. And this is primarily due to a pilot mental health program that we'll be taking up, focusing on fetal alcohol syndrome and culturally relevant mental health programming. And this next slide just goes into greater detail about the adjustments to the base in FY15. We have the $283,200, which is a transfer of expenditure authority from the old out-of-state contractual component to the regional and community jails component. And this is an inflationary increase. This is a cost of living. We cap the consumer price index at 2%. And then we add the school district geographic differential inflator for the various communities. And again, this shows the negative $2.5 million associated with Point McKenzie and the $1.6 million associated with the decrement for inmate health. And then this is a breakdown of the $214,400 of the temporary increments that the Mental Health Trust Authority passes on to the department. And at the bottom of this, you'll see a $1.8 million. It's a language section placeholder, and this had to do with the fund source change last year from general fund to federal receipts. At the time that the budget was developed, this was put in as a placeholder based on projections at that time, but it is no longer anticipated that this $1.8 million will continue to go forward. On slide 26, when we developed Goose Creek, we had a $50.5 million complete operations for the Goose Creek Correctional Facility upon full operational. And almost $2 million of that and 48 positions were reallocated out of that centralized component. And, you know, through discussing this over the several years, we had always talked about, you know, medical positions would be repointed to inmate health care. probation officers to probation and parole. So this just kind of gives you a breakdown to show you the $7.2 million that was moved into other components in the department. Then again at the bottom. Out-of-state contractual authorization changes. Again, this just shows how these monies were distributed. And slide 27 is the comparison of the budget allocation from FY14 management plan to FY15 governor's budget request. And again, it shows that highlights that decrement at the bottom of when all is said and done, $2.9 million. And this next slide just shows the three core service areas of the department and how that's funded. Obviously, secure confinement is the bulk of our budget. A little snapshot, our $5 million capital budget this year, it's 100% deferred maintenance. And then this just shows a list of the districts that are receiving these funds. These next slides are slides developed by the Legislative Finance Division. And this first slide shows the DOC share of general fund only. And then the blue line, which doesn't directly correlate, shows the total of all agencies department or statewide. This next slide shows that the different fund sources in the department. Obviously, the majority is undesignated general fund in the blue, and the yellowish area is designated general funds. And then we have our other state funds in the coral color, and then the green is our federal receipts. And these last two graphs are very close to the same. And then what this shows is the budget growth as compared to the 10-year plan. And the 10-year plan, I think, is a little bit closer in reality because we don't anticipate having the bump, so to speak, with Goose Creek Correctional Center phasing in over two fiscal years. We'll see that growth go down a little bit. That is the conclusion of our presentation.
A couple of quick questions before I page 6 of your slide.
Oops.
Page 6 of your slide. I knew that was going to happen.
Sorry, I'll get back to it.
Is this the comparison between 2002 and 2013, and the numbers is, how do you, the growth in prisoners, is that reflected or is it part of what we see as the difference between violent and nonviolent?
Representative Osterman, it's not the prisoner population growth, if I heard your question correctly. It's the percentage that are, you know, we had a much smaller number back in the first graph, but the percentage of them that were nonviolent was 44.
In the same comparison, numbers to numbers.
Correct. There is one difference. The slides that we've used previously were December 31st, which is it won't really matter on this graph, but that's usually our highest point of the year. This is as of June 30th. We've morphed all of our presentation material into his fiscal year, so we use June 30th. But so the numbers are a little different than what they would be if we did a December 31st snapshot, but it's the concept is the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
On page 12, how does this compare to national, nationwide? I mean, we see a decline going on here. Is this a decline going across the nation as well, or are we out?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. There is a decline that's going on nationally, especially for those departments that have began looking at recidivism as a measure and began changing their programs and focusing on reentry outcomes.
Okay. And then on the next page, 13, we talk about the number of offenders completing. I'm not sure that, I think I'd prefer to see a percentage based upon a year basis so that I can have a comparison of what's the reality and not just the numbers, because the numbers could be construed differently than what the percentage of your population is.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Okay. Questions? Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, Mr. Taylor, and Ms. Houston. Following on the chairman's question on the nonviolent offenders, would you characterize the type of offense? Could you characterize the type of offense in that nonviolent category? And the second question, as you're answering that, is it your classification? Is this only about their offense, or is it about your classification of nonviolent and violent as your management tool within the system?
Understand, Representative Stoltz, it's the crime they committed, and a crime against a person, including any sex offense, is violent.
What, Mr. Chairman? What's been the category of crime that has caused that growth?
Is it more crimes
or longer sentences? As combination of both, what is the? It might be less people for longer times.
One trend, and we probably have to do some research to completely answer your question, sir, but one trend I know in the last decade, sex offender sentences have doubled, and they fall into the violent category, so that definitely is a contributor. About 14% of our prisoner population are sex offenders, so it isn't going to make it or break it, but it definitely would be a contributor to that.
Those laws have been a great deterrent then, right?
We can get some more research and find out a little bit more about that. Unless we have it, do we have it at the table, or we?
I don't.
Okay.
And Mr. Chair, on page 8, your gender separation, there's been an apparent observation, and it's been a reality that you have a larger class of Alaskan Natives in prison. Does that same number tracked for your growth in gender? Are we seeing also a large class of Alaska Native female offenders?
Representative Stoltz, that's another we'd have to go get and get back to you with.
We're following this and how we're trying to address those those issues. It sure would, I guess, at the very least, it's, you know, if there's a curiosity. And and lastly, I appreciate the extra effort on Alaska Grown, and I think I'd like to see it tracking. I have a overall concern, not just on Valley and Matanuska and Tanana Valley produce, but also all of our Alaskan produced products, whether it be fish, whether it be it's the idea of making sure all of our products have a chance to get in there. Part of you wants to supposed to be in addition to reformation, there's supposed to be a little punishment, but I'm willing to let them have the best possible foods. That's it's good for the economy as well, and I'm not that mean a guy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I'm going to go stay on page 13 here, follow my co-chair's lead on this. When we're looking at outcomes, and we recently had a meeting in Wausau that talked about some of the Stop Valley Thieves issues that are going on there. We had the district attorney there, lead district attorney, talking about the majority of the crimes that go through the court systems there are people who are stealing, burglaries to support drug habits. Mm-hmm. How many people are you able to serve right now through drug treatment programs, and what effect is there on this? I see we have a positive effect, the way I'm reading his charts here. How many are you serving, and what is your need? I mean, how many people would like to go to those programs if they were available?
Through the chair to Representative Newman, if it's okay, sir, I'd like to, Ron should speak to the numbers. He runs the programs. But if I could, if you'd bear with me for a second, our programs, we're lapsing some money in our programs. And what happened, the reason that's happening is we built the program plan, and the operations folks, the program folks, built the contracts. And one of the things we were very careful of is to make sure that the state was protected and didn't pay for something that it didn't get. And so we put these things into effect, and we modified and tweaked and evidence-based and all that kind of stuff. And if there might be a time where the provider, the contractor, didn't give us a counselor or a provider of some kind for a number of months, Well, our contracts protected us from paying for that, and we're happy about that. But what it didn't address is we still, there's that six-month period we didn't pay for, but there's 6 months' worth of prisoners that didn't get counseled either. And then we find ourselves in a situation, we're not going to spend the money just to spend it. We're not going to try to move it somewhere else. We're going to give it back, explain what happened, and then hope that we can move forward with our budget request and make another run at it next year and go to our capacity. So on one hand, if we're talking about expanding capacity, if we lap some money, it doesn't make any sense to expand when we haven't used all of what we had. We have a plan for that. And so I thought I would just preface that. Ron, can you speak a little bit to the capacities?
Through the chair to Representative Newman. In terms of the capacity and need, I didn't bring the one slide with me that had all of the capacity numbers for our outpatient and our RSAT program. Wait a minute, 900 for outpatient, I believe, is what that is, and 180 for the RSAT program. The problem with the capacity numbers is you have to take into account what the commissioner is saying in terms of if we don't have counselors available or if there's wait lists involved in terms of services, then that would change who is able to get into the programming. With regard to need, we actually had an outside consultant come in and look at our overall program design. And it was very clear to us that in terms of knowing the exact need for substance abuse services inside of our system, we couldn't tell. What we can tell is that, yes, there are some needs that's there for substance abuse, but the exact number of how many, it's difficult, and partly because that's a voluntary program. Those guys are voluntarily going to substance abuse treatment, and they can decide when they are on the wait list or when they want to be pulled off. If we shift people to a different institution, they may have to start over in terms of the wait list or in terms of getting in access to the program. And what it does, it makes it very difficult for us to pin down the actual need. I can tell you that we've had about 6,000 of our risk assessments looked at over the last year, and we know that substance abuse is a high area of need. But a lot of those guys will choose to get that in the community where they're on probation and parole and they're required to do that. If they're just in the institution, they may not be required to do it in the institution. It's just a program plan recommendation that's coming from their risk assessment tool.
Another question?
Representative Newman. Of course, you took care of the... you're done?
Pardon?
Did you have another question?
Yes, sir.
Okay, please.
On page 16, you had a comment there that connect soon to release offenders to community-based resources. And again, just this morning, I was talking with Mr. Jeff Jesse from the Mental Health Trust in assisting, see what we can do to maybe the trust funding a half position and HES funding a half position to assist soon-to-released inmates, primarily your female inmates, who would qualify for Medicaid services so they don't fall off the cliff when they get out of jail that day. So how effective do you think this would be to help getting people on the right path if we were able to have them qualified, pre-qualified for Medicaid so the day on their release they can start receiving those Medicaid services and reducing recidivism?
Through the chair to Representative Newman, our experience, we've done some social work like that at Highland Mountain in our Eagle River facility, and it's proven to be very effective. I'd be a little hesitant to talk about specifically about Medicaid. That's more Leslie's area. But I can tell you that any kind of connection like that proves very, very valuable to the offender, to the community, you know, to a recidivism reduction effort. To your previous question about the program capacity, I hopefully explained why we didn't use all of our capacity last year. I think it's safe to say there is need beyond what we're providing, but we were afraid to come forward and ask for more when we still have to square away, you know, where we're at from last year. So,
well, Mr. Chair, the concern is, again, with the HES budget, are we going to be further ahead that, because the state covers 100% of those costs otherwise. You know, when they're receiving medical or go to the emergency room and stuff, we can pass off some of those costs to get some federal assistance funds on those. That's the whole part of it. And then particularly with the woman in need, women with children, trying to get them into adequate housing instead of being homeless, and those types of programs that will assist in helping reduce that recidivism.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have some other questions, but I want others to, other members to ask first.
And on the drug problem, you take care of the supply side when they're in prison, right? Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Burris, let me congratulate you. You are the fastest talking commissioner of
I'm
any.
Sorry. No, I'm sorry. All right.
Though your PowerPoints are longer, so it cancels each other.
Okay.
CFTC Commissioner Brown is a little faster.
Okay.
Welcome. I appreciate the work that the three of you have been doing. When you measure recidivism, let me go. Here's my main interest, and it's probably the main interest of most of the, or all of the, members of the committee. We want people, when they come out of jail, obviously to stay out of jail, and obviously not to commit crimes. A, it saves the state money, and B, it keeps our community safer, right? But I'm not sure how well we're doing. So when you talk about recidivism, I see the numbers going down, but you only measure like 3 years out, right? Is that correct?
Correct.
So we really don't know if 4 years out or 5 years out more people are coming back, or what's your answer to that?
Sure. Through the chair to Representative Guerra. I should say through the chair to Representative. When you look at the curve, when people reoffend, the first, most of them, most if not all, first 6 months. It's huge the first few months they're out, and it really starts to taper off after a year, 2 years, and 3 years. So we picked 3 years. The Judicial Council led that in 2007 when I read their first report. They saw that graph, so they decided back then there's really no point in measuring after 3 years, because one thing we get frustrated by is we might start a new program. We really can't speak intelligently to its efficacy until 3 years goes by after they've completed the program. So it might take us 4 or 5 years just to even talk about if it's working or not. So we try not to stretch that out farther than we can. But I can tell you, if you ever look at the graphs after 3 years, it doesn't help much anymore after that. So thank you.
Through the chair. I appreciate the fact that you do vocational training. Obviously, if somebody comes out of jail, they need a skill so they don't end up back in jail the next day. Mm-hmm. I see the vocational training efforts have increased, but what I didn't see, unless I missed it, is whether you keep track of whether people are getting jobs, whether more people are getting jobs when they come out, or what's happening to people when they come out. So vocational training is good for us to know, but it's only half of the puzzle. If we're doing vocational training and nobody's getting a job, mm-hmm. that doesn't do us any good. If we're doing vocational training and lots of people are getting jobs, that's great, but it also lets us know whether or not our vocational training expenditures are being wisely spent. So do we know, do we track?
I understand. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I don't think we're tracking that. We have a great relationship with the Department of Labor. They work with us on the Work Keys program, and they work with us on the GEDs, and that is certainly something that we could quickly put together. We have not been tracking. We don't know how many people are working as a result of the vocational training they received while in prison, I think is what we're focusing on, right? It might be tough because we'll know who's working and who isn't, but who would have worked without the training and who's working only because of the training might be a little tougher to present. But we could certainly, there's no reason we couldn't look into that and see if there's a way we could track that. Labor might have some, be able to help us with that. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just if we know if people are getting jobs, we know we're doing the right kind of vocational training. We obviously know the real answer, which is an employer, when they see that you have a felony on your record, is not very likely to hire you. So that's a tough job for you to get people back in the workforce. Mm-hmm. But we've got to know whether what we're doing is working, not just whether we're training people. I suspect it helps. And that's one final question, Mr. Chair. And if you could get that information to us, if you can. I don't know if it's available. I'm also one who believes that generally longer sentences for nonviolent criminals maybe cost the state too much. But do you have an analysis for me to make that conclusion? On page 7, you obviously show that we've got a much higher percentage of inmates are in there for nonviolent crimes because sentences have gone from 1 to 2 years to more than 1 to 2 years for a number of those crimes. Is there any way you could let us know what those crimes are so we can take a look at whether or not we overdid it in terms of sentencing. We don't know which ones to look at to possibly roll back and save the system money without knowing what the crimes are. We just know that there are more nonviolent criminals in jail, some of them may very well deserve that jail time.
Through the chair to Representative Gary, I agree with that. As a matter of fact, on the way over, I wondered myself how many of the 37-month or more people are violent versus nonviolent. When we talk about the group that's less between 1 and 2 years, did they become 2-year people or do they become more than 3-year people? And we do have the ability to pull that out. Mike could get into the computer and he could tell us in your office if you want how many of those folks are nonviolent and versus violent that are getting more time.
Mr. Chair, what I meant is the question was, which of the crimes did we increase the sentences on, gotcha, so that we can tell which of those nonviolent crimes should be where we put them or maybe should be rolled back a little bit?
I understand. And through the chair, we can find that.
Thank you. I agree with Representative Guerra in reference to the tracking of your vocab programs and stuff in prison. And it would be very, I think, beneficial for all of us if we could see some type of a recommendation coming from you guys about how you want to or how you would try to track that, just to see. I mean, as a business person, I'm not going to buy a bunch of widgets if nobody's buying them, and sure, there's no reason to train a bunch of people if nobody's hiring them. So that's a good point, and that's something I'd like to see.
And Mr. Chairman, I would agree, if we knew just how many were working, we could then start worrying about what to attribute that to. Yeah, so, sure.
And as I've told you when we met earlier on, this year's budget is considerably easier than what it's going to be in the next couple. Yeah. And while you have a department that's harder and harder to find where you will reduce costs, I appreciate that. But I am putting all of the departments on notice as we go to have conversations with them about what is what we're facing, and you can only weaken each department so far before you start cutting out programs. So with that, thank you very much for presenting today. And
can I ask one question real quick?
You're not on my list, but yes, you can.
Sorry. It's just a follow-up to your question, because Representative Guerra made it seem like it might be because we change things. But I know it could be, from some experiences I had in the interim, the judges may be taking our same laws and giving a different sentencing. So just to really understand what crimes they've been doing, it doesn't matter whether we changed or not, because it could be either one. So we just understand the crimes that they're being put into.
Sure. And through the chair to Representative Wilson, we look forward to that conversation. We can pull that data, some that I'm very confident we're going to be able to get, and then we can, you know, start a conversation about that. Sure.
Thank you again. Appreciate you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So at this point in time, we will ask, we will switch over to the Department of Revenue, and if the Commissioner Rodell will come up and bring her staff that she plans on having with her today, we'll move forward there.
Which one are you doing it for? Oh, you got it. Thank you.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm paying attention to your questions.
Yes. The capital budget has charted with another one side of 50 degrees.
Yeah,
well.
Okay, we're still in session. Good afternoon, Commissioner. Appreciate you joining us today. You can introduce yourself and your staff and start with your revenue forecast.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Angela Rodell. I'm the Commissioner of Revenue. To my right is Mike Pawlowski, my Deputy Commissioner for Strategic Finance. On my left is Pam Leary, the new Director for Treasury Division. Online, I know I have Deputy Commissioner Bruce Tangeman. He would have been here, except he ran into the same issues I think everybody else ran into earlier this week. So he and some of our staff are available online if there are specific questions that you want to get into. It's a pleasure to be here to talk to you about the fall 2013 revenue forecast. I think before I get started, I just would like to take a moment to remind the committee what the forecast is not. The forecast is not a description of all the things and all the potential that we see here in Alaska. It does not include things like the activity being done by Repsol with exploration or the BP exploration that's going on in MPRA. It also does not include the potential for heavy oil to come online. And so what we're really trying to do here is to create a reliable revenue forecast from which you can make your decisions on the next year's budget and moving forward. So with that, I'll move to slide 3 to talk about the revenue forecast and the trends that we've seen. Before you, you have the revenue forecast for both the actual revenue for 2012-2013. There are four primary factors that influence the revenue forecast. Those are oil prices, production, deductible lease expenses, and transportation costs. And what you see in 2012 is we saw an oil price of $112.65 that then declined to $107.57, and we have forecasted for fiscal year 14 an even lower oil price of $105.68 and continuing on that trend for fiscal year 2015 at $105.06. Production in 2012 was 579,000 barrels per day. That declined in fiscal year 2013 by over 40,000 barrels to 531,000 barrels per day. And we're forecasting in 2014 a continued decline to 508,000 barrels, with some leveling off to 498,000 barrels in 2015. Deductible lease expenses were approximately $4.4 billion in fiscal year 12, a slight increase in 2013 to $4.9 billion, and a much more substantial increase in lease expenditures to $6.6 billion, increasing even further to $7.2 billion. The good news with the substantial increase in lease expenditures is that is an indicator of activity up on the North Slope and potential future production down the road. General fund unrestricted revenues then for 2012 were $9.4 billion. Those declined to just under $7 billion in fiscal year 2013, and we are forecasting fiscal year 2014 revenues at $4.9 billion and to decrease further to $4.5 billion for fiscal year 15. You'll note we've seen a substantial decline in the production tax value per taxable barrel. In 2012, the calculation came to be approximately $79.33 as the value, and we saw that go down more than $12 in fiscal year 2013, and that declined even further in 2014 to $54.67. On slide 4, just to look at the components in greater detail and the actual changes that I alluded to, we see between fiscal year 12 and 13 changes of $47.8, $5.08 on price. Lease expenditures are up $519 million, and transportation costs are up almost $1.95. And this is what led to the decline in the tax value per barrel. Moving on to slide 5. Just to highlight again for you what's happened in the revenue forecast, oil price and production levels have been reduced, and correspondingly, unrestricted revenues have been revised downward from the spring 2013 forecast. The revenue impacts are largely due to changes in oil price, production, lease expenditures, and tariffs. We've seen, once again, a reminder, a substantial increase, $10 billion that's over and above already planned lease expenditure spending on the North Slope over the next 10 years. Oil companies have projected increased North Slope production following the increased activity. We continue to prudently assess our production, and the forecast is not intended to be this comprehensive assessment, but rather we will be adding these barrels in once it becomes we have more confidence in that production. And importantly, state investments are strong, and I have a separate presentation that I'll go to on state investment earnings. So looking at the components just of unrestricted oil revenue, the lion's share is petroleum revenue, with production tax comprising almost 58.5% of that. Royalty is the next biggest chunk, which in fiscal year 2013 comprised 25.5%. We actually see royalty making up a bigger share of the petroleum revenue in fiscal year 14 and 15 with in excess of 34%. Corporate income tax remains steady at 6.3% and around $435 to $460 million per year. Property tax is the smallest component related to petroleum revenue. So total petroleum revenue for fiscal year 2013 is approximately $6.3 billion, with $4.3 billion of that for fiscal year 2014 and $3.9 billion in 2015. Looking at our non-petroleum revenue, we have corporate income tax is the biggest component of that at 19.5% for fiscal year 13, and a slight decline in fiscal year 14, and then we're seeing a potential increase in corporate income tax collections in fiscal year 15. Mining tax continues to remain steady, as do insurance premiums, tobacco tax, and motor fuel taxes. Other tax, I'll remind the committee, we do administer 22 different tax types within the Department of Revenue, so we show for the committee's benefit the largest taxes that we collect, and all the other taxes are rolled into other taxes. Investment income is important to the revenue forecast as well. We're looking at $86 million in fiscal year 14. This is going to differ slightly from what you see in the state savings account presentation, because the state savings account presentation will include principal balances as of December 31st, whereas we cut the revenue sources book off at a much earlier time frame. So we have the addition of two more months of actual performance that I've included in the savings review. So total non-oil is about $577 million. So the bulk of revenue to the state is through petroleum-related revenues. When we look into moving beyond just the unrestricted general revenue, we have a designated general fund revenue forecast of about $329 million for fiscal year 14 and declining slightly to $327 million. We have other restricted revenues, which are related to the permanent fund. You'll see that in investment revenue and under the other restricted revenues, so $3.5 million, both for fiscal year 14 and 15. And federal revenues are expected to increase slightly now that we've moved beyond sequestration, and maybe the federal government may have a budget solution. I don't know. So moving on to the price sensitivity, one of the things that we have presented in the revenue sources book and that we present to the committee is the sensitivity of revenues to oil prices based on our production forecast. So what you see in this chart is our sensitivity to oil prices between for fiscal years 14, 15, and 16. I think one of the things to note here, if you compare this to past charts, is that we've narrowed the volatility of revenue, and so there's great potential for revenue based in 14, you have $2.3 billion at $50 a barrel and as much as $9.4 billion if oil prices reach $150. When we looked at the revenue forecast, one of the things we did is we looked historically, we looked back 10 years, and we looked forward 10 years to see how we were doing in the forecast based on our ability to forecast accurately or within an error rate, and what steps could we take to minimize the error rate and create confidence in the forecast. And you'll see over the years, 2009 was especially harsh on the state, and that was due to the global recession and everything that happened. I think we saw oil prices had a range that year between less than $40 and up as high as $140. 10 years ago, in 2004, we produced 973,000 barrels a day, and the price of oil was $32.36 a day. So compared to a fiscal year 13, which was 531,000 barrels versus $107 a price. So we're looking at some ways that we can add to our modeling of volatility or sensitivity of the forecast to various factors within the forecast itself. Moving on to the production forecast and methodology, one of the things that the department undertook recently was to, as I said, to reassess how we look at production and prudently add back barrels when it becomes more realistic that we include them. If we look back just as recently as fiscal year 2010, you saw a forecast for fiscal year 13 production that was well in excess of where it actually came in. I think it was over 600,000 barrels a day, and it was off by more than 100,000 barrels, and that was just 3 years ago. We have been working hard to bring in that error rate, and so one of the things we've done is really look historically into what we're doing. So when we look back at the bulk of production in the forecast of where it comes from, the majority of it has always been from the legacy fields like Prudhoe Bay. But as we move forward, we're seeing more and more production come online from other fields such as Endicott or Alpine, and that's a very important component as we look forward as to where future production is going to come from. As I said previously, we looked at past fiscal years and the forecast that we've done, and this gives you a sense of what those forecasts said and how those declines trended down. And so we took that data and we looked at how can we make this better? How can we make the revenue forecast better? And I think what's important here is you can see the error in how we were overly optimistic early on in production. So in 2005, for example, we predicted 2013 production would be well in excess of 800,000 barrels. By 2011, we were at just over 550,000 barrels to now where we are today at 538,000 barrels. So just to give you a reminder of how we looked at production in the past, we used to have three categories in this area, and it was currently producing, under development, and under evaluation. And we took all the information that we were given by the companies and we compiled it and worked with DNR and came up with a forecast. And I think what's important to note is that under development and under evaluation was really sort of speculative. It's, for example, the Repsol exploring, doing their exploration activities, or BP doing its exploration in MPRA, in the past would have been included in production, but we know that they're not there yet. And so we looked at how we can assess that and risk it so that we can prudently add that production back in. So we now have two categories, currently producing, which is not risked. Those are barrels we know are coming through the pipe, and new oil, which was these other two categories we had previously that we've now risked and done an assessment as to when we expect those to be added back in. And we created a trend line from that. So on slide 16, you can see the trend line that was calculated based on historical performance of actual production. From that, we did took the company data, did a risk adjustment, and then calculated a floor of, as if there was no new oil at all, what would happen. And from that, we derived a forecast. So when we look at the forecast, we really have the two categories, which is currently producing. We have new oil that's not GBR eligible. This is oil, additional oil coming out of the legacy fields. We have GBR eligible oil that'll be available for the tax credits under the More Alaska Production Act. And then the upside potential that you see there is, had we done the production forecast under the old methodology, what you would have seen as the production forecast, and you would have seen a leveling out of that production in the near term. Moving on to the price forecast, and we continue to examine ways that we can reduce the volatility in our price forecast. But to give you a sense of what happened historically since January 2012, when we were all here, gosh, I guess that's 2 years ago now. It doesn't seem like it should be 2 years ago. But there was a lot of disturbances within the Middle East that continued to affect the oil price forecast. So you had the Arab Spring going on during this. You had production, whether it was Lower 48 production coming online or elsewhere in the world. You had the European Union settling down with some of the fears it had around its fiscal problems. So we've seen the price move basically within this band between $100 and $120 per barrel. Since April 2013, when we last met, and we were seeing prices going back up, we've seen them come back down as a result of negotiating with Syria and Iran and calming the air around that. China has moved into more of a recession, so there are concerns about the Chinese economy, and so we're seeing that pressure downward on oil prices. On the other side of it, we're seeing issues around the oil being produced out of the Bakken Shale, for example, in the lower 48, which is increasing the cost of producing that because there are concerns about the volatility of that oil. It has some safety issues around it and whether or not those transportation costs are going to increase as a result. So we keep having these counterbalances on the price that seems to keep it within this band between $100 and $120 a barrel. Key oil price drivers continues to be supply and demand, and there are two main factors to monitor, which is global spare capacity and the cost of developing new oil, which is two of the things I discussed earlier. And we are currently in the process of developing a probability and statistical model that will incorporate this and help us more closely forecast prices in the future. As for our price forecast methodology this year, we held a day-long oil price forecasting session in October in Anchorage. Speakers provided insight. This is a tradition that has continued for many years now. We had over 39 participants from state government, academics, the Ledge Finance participates in that, and other outside participants. And they were asked to forecast real Alaska North Slope prices for the West Coast. And then those prices we adjust for an inflation factor of 2.5%, especially out 4 or 5 years, past 4 or 5 years. And we chose the median price path for each time period. Just in terms of volatility, one of the things we've seen in the last couple of years is a lot less volatility, which is good for all of us to see this band narrow. Whether or not it continues is anyone's guess. But just to give you a sense of what's happened, so in 2007, the average price, the actual forecast, or average, the actual price for us was $61.60. You can see it ranged from basically around $45 up to just under, that's probably around 70 to 75. Whereas in 2009, we had significant volatility, and that was due to the global recession that was going on. So looking at what happened in spring 2013, what we forecasted at, and what changed within the 8 months before we released the fall forecast. In the spring, we had forecasted oil prices to be $109.61. If you remember from the earlier chart, that was when we were seeing a lot of negative activity out of the Middle East and great concerns about what was happening in Syria and Iran. And so prices were on their way up. We have since moved off of that, and we have moved it down 3.6% to $105.68 for the fall forecast. Oil production, we had projected 526,000 barrels. That declined by 3.5% to 508,000 barrels. That was primarily due to an unexpected long summer maintenance session and reuse of gas, et cetera. So we had an unrestricted revenue forecast in the spring of $6.7 billion, and that declined to $4.9 billion. In fiscal year 15, you'll see similar adjustments made as a result of many of the same factors, production being lower than expected, prices being lower than expected, which results in lower than expected general fund revenue. On slide 26 and 27, this goes into the detailed changes with each of the factors. So the one I want to focus on page 26 is that the change in fiscal year 2014, we saw an increase of lease expenditures of $454 million from where we forecasted in the spring, and transportation costs went up significantly because there were fewer barrels to spread those costs again across production, and we assumed a 12.5% royalty. In the fiscal year 15 budget, or forecast, I'm sorry, we see those deductible lease expenditures going up twice as much to $1 billion, from $6.2 billion in our spring forecast to $7.2 billion in the fall forecast. So the major contributors and the influence of these contributors on the changes for each of the fiscal year. Fiscal year 14 is in gray. Fiscal year 15 is in the red color. So the bulk of the change in forecast from spring 2013 to fall 2013 forecast is due to the reduced price expectation. You can see that that had an impact in fiscal year 14 of almost over $500 million. Increased expenditures, lease expenditures, contributed over $300 million to the reduced revenue forecast. Production declines impacted it just under $300 million. Increased transportation costs, transportation charges influenced the fiscal year 14 just under $200 million. The closeout of the capital credits under ACEs has an impact of almost over $200 million. Because those are closed out, there is no impact on fiscal year 15 revenues. Property tax and corporate income tax changes also contributed, along with non-oil changes. And then the change in tax system decreased the revenue forecast by slightly under, you know, less than $100 million, and actually creates a positive revenue impact into fiscal year 2015, primarily due to the forecasted oil price. Looking at lease expenditures and slide 29 is capital expenditures, and slide 30 is operating expenditures. And we have them on separate slides to make it easier to read, but it's really nice to lay them, quite honestly, side by side, because you can see how the activity is happening here. So on the capital expenditures on slide 29, we see an increase of $67 million for fiscal year 14, and then a substantial increase in to $826 million in 15, and almost $1 billion in 2016. And that trend is up significantly over the red line, which was our spring 2013 forecast. When we move to the operating expenditures on the next slide, we'll see a much bigger increase in operating expenditures for fiscal year 14 of $319 million, and then a decline in these operating expenditures to $119 in 2015 and $146 in fiscal year 2016. And I think what the story that this presents for the committee is that we're seeing a lot of staffing up and activity going on to plan, because it takes a while to ramp up for these lease expenditures, and then we're seeing the company's forecast of actually spending on capital in 2 or 3 years. But what they're really investing right now with the operating expenditures is the staff and planning that it takes to get to that point. And that's a really exciting aspect that we're seeing of activity up on the North Slope. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I conclude my review of the revenue sources book, and I would either entertain questions or move on to the state savings account
if you want me to do that one and then save it all for questions, it, I defer to you at this point, sir.
That's why I have no questions now.
Thank you, Commissioner, and glad to say you've really come a long ways in the oil stuff and your revenue days and talks we had there. You said that was your goal. So I'm looking at your standard operating expenditures or your capital and operating expenses for standard allowable deductions. Your price per barrel for transportation costs are about $8.81 per barrel. What's your average cost on your standard allowable deductions with your CapEx and OpEx?
Total, through the chair, Representative Newman, total lease expenditures are about $45.99 contributed as a deduction, total deduction on that. And you can find that in the revenue sources book for the public. It's in it's in the appendix table E1.
So what have we seen in an increase in the amount of standard allowable deductions, basically, in the last few years and percentage-wise per year? The last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, I'm going to defer that to Deputy Commissioner Pawlowski.
Thank you. For the record, Mike Pawlowski, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. Representative Newman, through the chair, there's two things we see going on. First is the production decline over the last 2 years has, as we just showed, been much more pronounced than we thought it would be. We've seen a significant decline. At the same time, you see an increase in investment. Well, as you know, the way our lease deduction system works is you take the expenditures and divide it by the barrels. If you have more expenditures over less barrels, the value of the lease deductions per barrel goes up. It's similar to what's happening in TAP. So what we're seeing both recently and going forward is until that production curve really starts to materially turn around, the lease expenditures per barrel are going to stay high. And I believe this revenue forecast was the first time we've really put that out as a production tax value per barrel so members of their staff, the public, can start to do some of those calculations. And that's page 3 of this presentation.
Yeah, I'll just clarify that a little bit. You know, through the last changes in legislation on oil taxation, standard allowable deductions are one of the things that probably didn't change. You know, for what's available for CapEx and OpEx. You start at point of production minus transportation and your operating expenditures. My question is how much, again, are we allowing industry, what have we seen in the growth in industry for allowable deductions? There's a percent per barrel that's usually allowed. The transportation's only went from $7 to $8.81 in the last 5 years. So, you know, we used to feel the cost for the production per barrel. I think when we did ACES was $30, and now we're at $44. Is that what we're saying?
Representative Newman, through the chair, that's correct. I think something that helps is to go back in the presentation to slide 10. And we tried to put as much data as we could in this slide. And if you think back to when people were looking at ACES around fiscal year 2008, you had roughly 215,000 barrels a day more of production. And again, as you said, the lease expenditures haven't changed. What's really driving the change in the deductions per barrel is that there's just simply less barrels. And that is the same cost being deducted over fewer barrels. And that's part of the reason turning around the production is so important. And what we've seen recently is a dramatic increase in forecast investment. And we believe that's leading to production, but as the commissioner said, it's a little too early to start to add in all of those barrels that we see discussed out there yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Costello.
Oh, thank you. What, if anything, can we extrapolate from the lease expenditures under Senate Bill 21, which just kicked in less than a month ago, and the capital expenditure credits under ACES in terms of something meaningful? I mean, Does lease expenditure, do lease expenditures mean something? Can we extrapolate something from them in terms of what the companies are doing and what we can expect in terms of the production versus the capital expenditure credits, which I think what we felt as a legislature was you can't really extrapolate anything out of that because it's meaningless. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Costello, I think that's a good question because one of the fundamental changes in I think between ACES and SB 21 was changing the nature of the credits along with so the capital credits in the past were for deductible expenses, and we didn't really tie that to production in the way we did under SB 21. So we have credits in SB 21, but they're directly tied to oil production, and they won't be able to realize those credits until those barrels of oil are actually produced. So what does that mean for the lease expenditure question that you asked? Well, we have seen a substantial increase in the lease expenditures, which means that companies are clearly motivated to continue to expend on capital, make those capital investments into the slope to produce those barrels of oil, because now they're not going to get the credit unless they produce the barrel of oil if they want that credit. Secondly, we've given them a much more reliable tax regime within which to plan to make those lease expenditures, because if you remember under ACES, one of the difficulties for all the parties, including the state quite honestly, was that we didn't know month to month what the revenue was going to be because it was so dependent on what happened to prices, what happened on production. So it was very volatile. And so just like we had a hard time making decisions sometimes because we weren't sure about what the revenue was going to look like, the companies were unwilling to make a commitment to the extent that they are currently making because of that unreliability of not knowing how much they were going to have to lay out in the form of a tax liability. So I think that combination of those two things was very important to why we're seeing such an increase in the lease expenditures and why it leads to a sense of the potential for new production to come online, because there's real incentive now on the part of the companies to get that oil into the pipe.
Just one follow-up.
Representative Costello.
Actually, it's not a follow-up. Through the chair or through the co-chair, Commissioner, an idea that I have found appealing in the past and keep coming back to, and it's driven by just how our budget is driven by the revenue that we bring in, is the idea of hedging our oil. Mm-hmm. And this may not be a question for you, but are you aware, do other oil provinces hedge their oil? And can you comment on that?
Sure, through the chair. Representative Costello, I think a number of places look at it. I would have to go back and find actual instances of hedging going on. But in terms of the state, it is something that the state has periodically reviewed over the years. There are different methodologies into hedging oil, whether you want to hedge it based on oil prices and say, you know, we'll buy a hedge at a certain spot price for oil, and if it falls below, we get a payment. If it goes above, and we'll assume 200,000 barrels a day at that price, and that's the hedge. I think the state traditionally has been uncomfortable with hedges and how they would work, but it is definitely something I would like to explore with the committee further if it's interested in it.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Pulaski, our commissioner, actually, welcome, first of all.
Thank you.
Mr. Pulaski goes second. Commissioner, Mr. Pulaski came before the committee last year, and I just want to make sure we're comparing apples to apples, and said we've very much changed the way we forecast oil production. We've come up with a new way to do it. This was what they did for the spring 2013 revenue source book. And basically it was, we're going to count speculative oil at a lower rate, we're going to count real known oil at a higher rate, and the speculative stuff, we'll just see if it comes on. Between, that's the process you're still using, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, I'm looking at the revenue source books, and I remember the governor and Commissioner Sullivan talking about a million barrels a day, and what I see is less oil in 2022 under the fall 2013 revenue source book under SB 21 than I did in the spring 2013 revenue source book for 2022 when ACES was still the law. So what I see is actually the decline rate is much higher under SB 21. If you look at the spring source book, you have a prediction in 2017 of 477,000 barrels of oil a day. That goes down to 344,000 barrels a day under ACES. So that's a decline of 130,000 barrels between 2017 and 2022. And now I look at the new revenue source book, and there's a decline of 142,000 barrels of oil between 2017 and 2022. It goes from 482,000 in 2017 down to 340,000 barrels in 2022. So we lose roughly 10,000 barrels of oil more under the new revenue source book done under SB 21 than we did under the spring 2013 revenue source book, so higher rate of decline. And there's less oil in the pipeline in 2022 under SB 21, roughly 340,000 barrels of oil, compared to the spring 2013 revenue source book, 344,000. I'm just talking about North Slope oil because Cook Inlet oil is taxed differently. So my first question is, I guess, where's the million barrels of oil a day, and why is the decline rate greater now than it was when the revenue source book under ACES was presented to us in the spring of 2013?
Through the chair, Representative Gehr, I'm going to start with that question, and I'm going to turn it to Deputy Commissioner Pawlowski as well for added color. But I think one thing that is important that I think you pointed out is that we took currently producing as the starting point, and we do a risk assessment. And in the spring 2013 forecast, we are taking from the company's information about what their plans are for that coming summer and what that activity will lead to over the course of the next 10 years with that activity. And so every 6 months when we update the forecast, we're incorporating that new set of knowledge, applying the new methodology so that we have consistency between forecasts from fall to spring to fall to spring, so that there isn't a question of what happened before and after or treating something differently. And so what has happened in that forecast period is what we're hearing about when things are expected, what's going to happen, and what's happening with the currently producing fields and the runout rate on those currently producing fields. So we've got better information about what's being currently produced, and that is what's causing the adjustment in the 10,000 barrels. I'll turn it to my deputy commissioner to add to that.
Thank you, Commissioner. Again, for the record, Mike Pawlowski, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue. There are a lot of things going on in the forecast, and I apologize, I don't have the previous forecast to compare the numbers against them. I think what's really changed a lot is why we put fiscal year 12 and 13 in the slides this year, is because when we shift forecast to forecast, we often forget to look back at what actually happened. And the decline from 12 to 13 and 13 to 14 was significantly more than we thought it would be. And so the forecast going forward from today is starting from a much lower base than we even thought it would be last year. If you remember, we pointed out that our forecast in the last year, this is slide
20.
Slide 26. In the spring, we were predicting that there would be 18,400 barrels a day more in 2014 than we actually think we're going to see. And you move on to FY15 now, we've revised that down by 14,400. Those are all happening in the near term. Those are data that came in from January backwards. So as we look forward, again, we did not want to change the methodology one year to the next. And that is why we describe, I believe, at the department, the upside potential that we see out there. But at the same time, we have to remember what the production forecast is and what it is not. It is not a total assessment of the barrels that are out there. It is a component of a revenue forecast. And the department has a record of not being conservative or prudent in giving you a long-term production forecast to base your revenue numbers off of. So we try to keep it consistent year to year, but we've seen much bigger actual declines than we thought we would. So when you start from that lower number, it changes how things go out into the future today.
Thank you. Mr. Pulaski, I mean, the revenue methodology you changed back in the spring, it's the same revenue methodology now. I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. You couldn't predict exactly what this year's oil production was going to be. The promise under SB 21 was a few years out, all of a sudden you're going to see all this new oil. But between 2017 and 2022, the decline rate is faster now under this new source book, under SB 21, than it was under the old source book in the spring. So giving you the benefit of the doubt that it takes a few years for stuff to come online and we see these TV ads of all this brand new investment, you go down under the same methodology in 2013, under the ACES predictions, you go down 130,000 barrels between 2017 and 2022. But now under SB 21, you're going down 142,000 barrels between 2017 and 2022, a faster decline rate. I guess where's the beef?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, if I can. I think there's two places where we see the real opportunity. First of all, the lease expenditures are up dramatically. There's a lot of investment happening. That investment translating to barrels is still something that the department is extremely cautious about including. But when you look at the graph with the upside potential, what you see is a flattening out, an increasing of production, and a flattening out in the longer term. I know we had discussions last year consistently about, is it going to be a 2% decline, 3% decline? How that matches up against what we would see in an unrisked format is something that I think is worthwhile doing a little back and forth and just pushing around on the data. But we see the opportunity. We see the upside potential. We see the investment happening. But for us to take all of that and translate it into, here are the numbers we're going to use to produce dollar estimates for you to guide your long-term budgeting and OMBs, we're just not at that point yet.
Finally, Mr. Chair.
As long as it's not the same mantra, we're not going to debate Senate Bill 21, and I think they've explained it well enough that they're not using Senate Bill 21 as their forecast tool.
Through the chair, I'm not going to debate about the new investment and whether it would have happened anyway. Another day. But I'm just now looking at the revenue forecasts. What we saw in the spring forecast was revenue under the production tax of roughly $3.6 billion in 2018. In the current forecast, now that's down to $2.2 billion. And in 2022, when things are supposed to kick in, under the spring forecast, we were at $2.8 billion in production tax revenue. And in 2022, under the new forecast, we're down to $2.05 billion in revenue. Why by 2022 is the new revenue not kicking in?
Through the
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think that's why we walk through all the different components of petroleum revenue. So the largest component is the production tax. And so when we have the decline in production tax, because we're seeing the decline in price and the other factors, the increase in lease expenditures, there's a decline in petroleum revenue, primarily in the production tax, which then gets reflected into the total unrestricted general fund revenue available to the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quick question. Everything on revenue forecast and production forecast is based on ANS, but we also have Cook Inlet producing gas and oil, and is any of that included in any of your revenue forecasts?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Osterman, we do include some amounts for Cook Inlet. It's important to remember that the tax rate on oil for Cook Inlet is 0%, and for gas, it's, I think, roughly 18%. So it shows up differently. We're seeing activity in Cook Inlet and increased production. I believe it's reflected in the tables in the appendix, table D, and it's seen an increase in deductible lease expenditures as well in Cook Inlet and application for credits.
In your forecast book, is it separated out?
Representative Osterman, through the chair, Mike Pawlowski, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue again. We do not separate out Cook Inlet as a specific component in the revenue forecast. This year, I believe, is the first one. As Commissioner Rodell said, we've actually tried to break out lease expenditures for committee and members of the public to be able to track what's going on in Cook Inlet. We have recently tasked internally at the department, assuming there would be some questions about Cook Inlet, a commercial analyst to do a comprehensive analysis of Cook Inlet so we can bring it back to the committee and start to discuss what's actually going on in Cook Inlet between the royalty side, the production tax side, maybe some of the credits, but we're working through some of the legal issues now. What we've been able to give is the lease expenditures so that you can do some calculations and break things out yourself in the interim.
You do keep track of the production?
Representative Osterman, Mr. Chairman, yes, we do keep track of the production, but not the revenues from that production as a distinct number.
I follow that, but why wouldn't you keep track of the revenues?
Mr. Chairman, until recently, I believe it's because production has frankly been so small that the revenue component from Cook Inlet was relatively modest. And it wasn't something that the department was paying the detail level of attention to that we see is necessary going forward.
So do we pay, does the state pay out credits on Cook Inlet gas and oil?
Mr. Chairman, the state very much does pay out credits on Cook Inlet gas and oil.
I think it would be interesting for this committee to see the difference between what's going on in Cook Inlet on gas and oil. What the true numbers are, mm-hmm. because I think that's something that the public should see and should understand. So if you can get that information to this committee, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, we'd be happy to. As I said, we tasked somebody to specifically put a presentation together for the committee, and we'll work with your office to set that up.
All right, thank you. Representative Stoltz, you had a question?
You know, Mr. Chairman, I had a whole series of questions, but I know we have another part of the presentation, so I'll just take 30 seconds to also welcome the commissioner and appreciate everything I've known about you as a deputy commissioner and what I've heard about you from the professional world and your qualifications. I really welcome you and look forward to pushing the green button. But I would just say Mr. Pawlowski is a brilliant person, but I would not want to designate him as my color guy.
Duly noted, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I think that was like the color commentator. It's in all sports. You did a great job. You went fast. I'm trying to catch up on some things. At the very beginning in your open statement, you talk about economic activity that you were not including in your report So at what point do you include it? At what point is it relevant?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, it becomes relevant, I believe, when we have an actual expectation and see the investment. So in the past, we had underdevelopment, which is that you saw pads being laid, drill work being done, things being put in place to actually pull oil out of the ground, as opposed to activities related to under evaluation category, which is, you know, testing drills. Are we going to find oil? Are we going to find gas? What are we going to find when we stick a hole in this part of the ground? That type of thing. So we're seeing a lot of exploration activity, which would be under evaluation, the application, you know, and it becomes more relevant to the production forecast when it has moved up through out of that phase into under development, and now we're seeing it in a much shorter time frame as opposed to 5-10 years. And I think probably the best example that the committee is familiar with, quite honestly, is the Liberty Field activity. And for a long time, we included in our production forecast a tremendous amount of production out of Liberty that never materialized. And so that has subsequently been taken out of the forecast. And it's not, and our goal is to not include that type of activity thinking it's going to save the day 10 years down the road because we see this field when it never materializes in the way that it was described initially. So
Mr. Chair, on page 5 you talk about $10 billion increase in spending on the North Slope is over the next 10 years. Do you build that into this equation? Where is that from? When does that, is that relevant or not relevant, or which calculation is that in?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. So that is a forecasted plan of expenditure that's given to the department and Department of Natural Resources. And we do take that, and we don't take it dollar for dollar. We do an assessment against it based on what we're actually seeing. So we don't necessarily take their word fully for it. And we incorporate it in the years in which the companies state that they expect to take those deductible lease expenditures in. So if they have an expectation to spend, $3.5 billion in 2021, it may have been that their actual expectation was something larger than that, but we have adjusted it accordingly given other information that we have and included that. And it affects the revenue picture negatively because it is deductible from tax revenues.
If I may, Mr. Chair, this is an old field. I mean, Prudhoe Bay is old. I was a young man when I worked up there for 25 years. I mean, I know what the feel of that steel is when it's cold and when it's hot.
Mm-hmm.
Those facilities are getting to be very old.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them are almost antiquity. When you talk about new developers looking to get into the fields the cost of using those facilities. For some of them, they're so inefficient, building new facilities is the answer for them. This is what I've been told by the conversation. And I'm just wondering if you're seeing the increased operating expenses to maintain old, inefficient equipment in there as compared with them having to replace things. Have you seen that? I mean, we're not talking about well pads. We're talking about replacing GC1, GC2s. You know, I mean, I can name those facilities I worked on.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I don't believe we're seeing it in the operating expense side so much as we're seeing some of it in the capital expenditure side. And really the goal, for the producers up there, is really to see how far they can extend the life and still make it economic on their part. And there will be a point, I would think, that they're going to reach a point where some of the infrastructure and the cost of maintaining and improving that just is not worth it, given what the wells are yielding, and so the investment will be into new platforms, new areas of the fields, of the units.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, and you have a clear, you think you have a clear understanding of the difference between the OPEX and the leased expenditures? I mean, considering we're far behind on our auditing.
Through the Chair, Representative Gutenberg, I think we have a very good sense of operating versus capital expenditures, and I understand what, but I think it's important to note that we are doing monthly DUS audits, so we have a pretty good, very good handle on what these companies are doing on a monthly basis. So I feel very confident about the differences between the operating expenditures and the capital expenditures.
Oh, I have more, but I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Representative Costello, do you have something, or do you want to?
No, thank you.
All right, let's go ahead and take up the business account update.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving on to an update on the state savings account, and this is always a presentation that I enjoy giving. And the markets have been kind to us over calendar year 2013. So we'll start with what we call the general fund and other non-segregated investments, or JFONSI. And this is really the base general fund from which we manage our cash on a daily basis. This has a very moderate risk profile. It's invested in short to intermediate investment horizon. On December 31st, 2012, you'll see that we had a market value of $11.79 billion. And on December 31st, it was a balance of $5.7 billion. I don't want to alarm the committee. We didn't lose over $5 billion. In the past, we had kept the statutory budget reserve as an investment in JFONSI into this asset allocation. And in 2013, starting with fiscal year 2014, July 1st, we moved it out, so it's still in the general fund, but it has a different asset allocation than this, because this is highly liquid. And when we looked at the statutory budget reserve fund, we saw opportunities to extend the duration slightly. So you'll see the statutory budget reserve as a separate slide here, but I want to assure the committee that it is still within the general fund. Year to date, that's calendar year to date performance, is 0.22%. And our fiscal year to date in fiscal year 14 year to date is 0.28%, which are both beating the benchmarks. Next, we have the statutory budget reserve fund, and this too has a moderate risk because we know that it needs to be available for use. In 2012, we had an amount attributable to it of almost $5.5 billion. In December 31st, 2013, it had a balance of $4.77 billion. That's primarily due to the draw that was used to balance out when we closed out fiscal year 13. The fiscal year 13 performance was 0.31%. The year-to-date performance on the statutory budget reserve is 1.08%. You can see the value of extending that duration on the statutory budget reserve to increase yield just a little bit. And our fiscal year-to-date is 1.15%, also just slightly beating the benchmark. In the constitutional budget reserve, we divide that into two separate asset allocations, a subaccount and a main account. The main account has a risk profile of moderate risk, similar to the statutory budget reserve. It has a balance of $5.8 billion, and it had a fiscal year-to-date performance of 0.18%, and year-to-date we're looking at a negative 0.25%. That's primarily due to the exposure to the bond market this has. So if you remember, as interest rates rise, bond prices fall. So when we do our mark-to-market, the valuation goes down. So one of the things that we are examining internally within the department is what we can do to mitigate against the potential losses due to increasing interest rates. The subaccount, because it has a longer duration and is allowed to take more risk and has exposure to the equity market, has done very well this year. Fiscal year 13, it brought in a performance of 11.75%, and our year-to-date is already at 15.85%. This fund amount has increased from $5.5 billion to $6.3 billion, and so it's created a very nice, healthy reserve. On the Power Cost Equalization Fund, this fund in statute requires us to target 7%. If we add an inflation factor onto that, that's closer to 9%, 9.5%, depending on what you want to assume for inflation. So this has 80% in equities. It has a very high equity concentration asset allocation, and so therefore it really benefited from the equity market performance in calendar year 2013. The fund balance went from $787 million to $937 million over the course of the year. Moving on to the Public School Trust Fund, this has a more moderate risk profile. It has an equity allocation of approximately 42%. So you can see that it, too, benefited from having an investment in equities, but not nearly to what the Power Cost Equalization Fund had. It increased in a balance from $487 million to approximately $436 million and had a fiscal year return of 8.19%. Year-to-date, it's looking at 10.6%, beating the benchmark. And then we moved the earnings out into the income fund, and that's just invested in short-term instruments. Looking at PERS and TERS, this has a target asset allocation of trying to achieve 8%, but given the long duration 30-year time horizon we have on PERS and TERS, we're allowed to take a more expansive asset allocation and invest in things that may not be as liquid as an equity or bond market, for example, in real assets, which is timberland, farmland, et cetera. So PERS increased from $12 billion to a little over $14 billion from 2012 to 2013, again, really benefiting from the equity market performance in 2013. And you saw TERS went from a little over $5 billion to $5.8 billion. The returns are around 12.6%. Which is considerably better than the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, which has a shorter time horizon on it. And then moving on to the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, they have a long-term goal of 5%. It's less than PERS and TERS because of the nature of the fund. It's designed to be maintained into perpetuity as long as we're a state. So it has a slightly less riskier profile, but it too, once again, because of its long time horizon, invests in much less liquid assets such as infrastructure or real estate, timber, orchards, farmland, that kind of thing. So on December 31st, 2012, it had a balance of $43.6 billion. And by the end of 2013, it had a balance just under $50 billion of $49.2 billion. We looked at a fiscal year 2013 performance of 10.93%, and year-to-date, they're at 12.2%. So all the investment accounts are very healthy and doing very well. I'm very happy to report. So looking at the impact on the revenue forecast, and this is where the changes are slightly different than what you find in the revenue sources book, because this is actual performance through December 31st with a forecast then for the balance of the 6 months in fiscal year 14. We've increased the amount from approximately $80 million in investment income for fiscal year 14 to a little over $101.9 million for the unrestricted general fund revenue. The CBR subaccount will increase almost $778 million over that for the fiscal year. So we're looking at, with the permanent fund as well,
a total of investment revenue of $4.9 billion to the state, including the permanent fund. So that concludes my review of the state savings accounts, and I would entertain any questions you might have here.
Questions?
Alan.
Well, I guess we're all happy with the amount of money you're getting. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I'm actually happy with how much the permanent fund has gone up. Ms. Riddell, sometimes we'll put money into savings, but that counts as spending. I'm looking at page 4. I understand that we withdrew roughly $1 billion to balance the budget. But was any of that $1 billion money that we actually put into savings into some savings account somewhere, or that was an actual draw because of spending?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, my understanding is that the $700 million is all to reconcile the accounts. It wasn't to move money out of into any of the savings, no.
Okay. And just one other question, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at the PERS, CHERS pages. I'm hoping. Page 8, you show great returns for PERS and CHERS. So I'll just look at PERS. From 2011 to 2013, the balance has increased to $14 million by about $4 million. Has that balance kept pace with the liabilities? Has it exceeded the liabilities? Do you know?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, unfortunately, it has not exceeded the liability, and therein lies the governor's proposal to move $3 billion into here. The liability is considerably more than the assets. We're looking at a liability roughly of $12 billion.
That's increased faster than the income, or than the balance.
It did, and to go back through to the chair, if I can continue to go back, when we have a loss, for example, like we did in 2009, which was roughly 20%. Not only do we have to make up 20%, but we have to make up the additional 8% we were counting on earning that year to counteract that liability. So we have to make up 28%, and we have the 3-year actuals and the 5-year actuals, and it's very nice because we don't have then 2009 rolling into that calculation anymore. But if we looked over a 10-year, or if we looked over the 8-year period we've been tracking this, you would see something sub 8%, and it's that which has lent to the liability that's trying to be overcome at this point.
Thank you.
Seeing no questions.
I do have a question.
Representative Costello.
Thank you.
That'd be a good one. We're counting on you.
No question.
Commissioner, could you tell us about the Public School Trust Fund? What is that used for?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, I'm actually going to let Ms. Leary, my director of Treasury Division, actually answer that question because she works with it much more intimately than I do.
For the record, Pam Leary, I'm the Treasury Division director through the chair. Representative Costello, the Public School Trust Fund provides a component, I think, to the Formula Foundation, and it represents, I think it's 0.5% of the oil revenue goes into the fund itself, into the principal fund. And then the principal fund has earnings and grows, the interest and dividends of which go into the income fund, and that's what's used as part of the budget for the education.
Follow up?
Yes.
So, you know, often we go back and forth about do we or do we not forward fund education. Is this where we can say that we are forward funding education?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, this is not where we say we forward fund education. And I would defer, quite honestly, to OMB to point to you specifically as to where you can see the forward funding of
education within the budget itself.
So through the chair, so this fund is simply just another way that we help fund education?
Through the chair, that's correct. So this is the specific entitlement that public schools were given, the public school trust fund created from that oil tax revenue. So some goes to the permanent fund, royalty revenue goes to the permanent fund, some goes into the public school trust fund, and then we spin off the income to make it available for appropriation.
Thank you. And since being commissioner, have you read any film scripts lately?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, we continue to get film scripts on a monthly basis to review. So
it's, you didn't answer the question. Are you reading them, or are you, does you pass that on to your colorful deputy?
Unfortunately, I'm not allowed to delegate that responsibility according to statute, so it's all on me to read.
So we're not getting a bunch of Star Trek films.
And a lot of money.
All right, Commissioner, thank you very much. Appreciate your presentations today.
Thank you.
Co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To bring before the committee House Bill 265, and that's the, I guess, just as a formality, by tradition, we don't pass this bill. Mr. Vice Chair, do you have a copy before you, 265?
Is that one of my bills, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Just as a formality, although we're not going to, by tradition, not dealing with this, if you, Mr. Vice Chair, if you could move that bill for our committee's deliberations.
I'd like to move House Bill.
Not move out.
Stop.
Far enough outside.
Just to adopt it for our consideration.
I'd like to adopt House Bill 265 version /A for committee referral and discussion.
Without objection, obviously not our intent to begin consideration of this bill today, but I did want to let the committee know I'm working with the co-chair of finance and the other body, the Senate, I guess that's what they're called, to try to hold some joint meetings. I'll have to work with our subcommittees to, because it'd probably be 9 o'clock meetings to jive with them, but I would like us to have a chance to take a review of at least the governor's portion of the submissions and bring up general questions about the capital budget earlier in the process than we have. And that's, an old dog can learn some new tricks and take good suggestions from folks. So it's our intent to try to work that out, to at least have one or two joint meetings with the state agencies and to begin asking questions about some of these items in the budget earlier than we usually get the opportunity to. And we hope to have the governor's office here earlier than that in this body to go through the budget. I would like to take advantage of the other body meeting as well. And looking forward to working with everybody on that. It's going to be a there have been discussions about maybe getting it to us earlier. We haven't always had jurisdiction over that. Sometimes we don't get it well into the next legislative special session. So it's that said, we're always trying to improve the public process, and we work within the constraints we have. So look forward to working with everybody on this. It ought to be a lot easier because there's going to be less money, which makes us think, I say that only tongue-in-cheek, it's going to make our decisions more deliberative, and I think we'll make better decisions as a result. Now with that, I'm going to set aside House Bill 265 for a future meeting.
Are you going to do 66 and 67?
Oh, you want me? Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, you want to just get them on the table? And yeah. Maybe the vice chair can move those. The two budget bills.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move for consideration House Bill 266 version /A for committee referral and consideration.
Hearing no objection, Mr. Chair, you'll have other plans. We're already working on those. And 267.
Chair, I'd like the to adopt House Bill 267 version /A for committee referral and discussion.
Hearing no objection, that's the mental health trust bill. Co-chair, is there any other?
No, that's the end of the business for today. I will say that tomorrow we will meet at 1:30 again, just like we did today with corrections and revenue. We will hear from Department of Labor and the Mental Health Trust Authority. So with that, if there's nothing else to come before the committee, we're adjourned.